ladies and gentlemen, it is I who feel honored this afternoon to have the opportunity to address a group that has done so much over the years to improve, to educate, and to arouse the conscience of the nation. Let me take just a moment to express my fervent hope that your distinguished President Vernon Jordan, an old friend, a valiant warrior who has always dared to tell the truth even to the most powerful, will soon return to the battle with undiminished strength. I appear before you at a troubled time for our nation. In the past decade, economic mismanagement and energy dependence have steadily deepened the cycle of inflation, of recession, and unemployment. And many groups have suffered, but few have suffered as much as Black Americans. And recent events, and very traumatic events in such widely separated places as Liberty City and Chattanooga and Orlando, are ominous signs of a resurgent tide of bitterness and despair over these conditions. Because for most Black Americans, the 1970s were a lost decade. And that is a fact that is simply not understood by most white Americans. In a recent poll, 84% of whites thought that blacks were better off now than they were 10 years ago. But they are dangerously wrong. Because as you heard from the distinguished speaker who preceded me at the podium just a few minutes ago, and I've read his remarks, and they're very excellent remarks, and it saves me, I think, repeating some of the statistics that otherwise I would give you. But I think I have one to add to those that he mentioned, and that is that for every black family that entered the middle class, and we hear, of course, so much about the fact that blacks are becoming a part of the broad middle class of this country, that for every family that entered the middle class during the 70s, there were three who were added to the ranks of the poor. But I could go on, but you know those statistics and the human tragedies that underlie them as well or better than I. And I think the message is clear that the nation needs a new battle plan, that it should never have declared a truce in the war on poverty. You've listened patiently to a long line of speakers, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but I do want to tell you as clearly as I can in the few minutes that I have with you what I intend to do as President of the United States. But even as I seek to do that, I recognize a serious obstacle, and let me very frankly state it. And that is that a great many Americans have come to doubt that any president can make much of a difference. I don't think that's true. I think that when you have a president who is a vigorous problem solver, not simply a tinkerer. When you have someone who is a real moral leader and not just a moralizer. When he is a public... And when he is a public figure who is not afraid to have the people hold him responsible for the state of the nation, then he can make a difference. And that's exactly why I am running for president as an independent. I think the two major parties and the candidates that they are likely to nominate, one already nominated, one likely to be nominated next week, that they have failed in their responsibility to the American people, and that an independent free of the constraints placed upon those who today are functioning within a party system that has grown, I think, rather tired and rather unresponsive to the real demands and wishes of the people. That it is in that context that I plead, particularly with the blacks in this country, don't mortgage your future to a single party simply because you have been part of a coalition that is to be sure lasted for almost 50 years. Why should you be obliged once again to say, yes, we will accept whatever nominee you give us, whether or not we really feel in our hearts he is capable of translating our dreams and our hopes into something more positive. I believe that the basic problem of black America is jobs, that it is jobs that make the difference between security and fear, between opportunity and closed doors, between hope and despair. The employee, once they have a job, can begin to chart a decent life for themselves and their families. The employee simply cannot do that. It's as simple as that. And nowhere is the problem of jobs any more serious than it is among black youth in our country. And you know, the problem really begins with education. In a modern economy, you have to know how to read and to write and to compute if you're going to hold a job or even be trained for one. And the number of openings for uneducated, unskilled workers is rapidly declining. The nature of the workforce has changed very dramatically. But our system of public education is simply failing to instruct our young people in basic skills. Bernard Watson, a name that is surely known to this group, has said that the education of too many children in the classroom is nothing short of a national scandal and a national disgrace. In a platform that offers black Americans only cutbacks and rhetoric, that, as one political writer put it very well indeed, that even wanders over the permissible line that you can draw between simply political rhetoric and utter sentimentality. Ronald Reagan has called for the abolition of the Department of Education. I say let us use the Department of Education to reverse the mounting failure of our school systems. Let's stop wasting money on educational experiments and get back to some of those basics. Let's make our schools safe and secure. Let's make public education once again an attractive career for our ablest college graduates. And more importantly, I think, and the black community has been talking about this in their desire for community control of schools for years, let's make our public schools accountable again. Because I believe that with a quality basic education, every child can learn how to read and to write and to compute and study, and that quality basic education actively encouraged by the federal government, I promise you, is going to be one of the very first priorities of an Anderson presidential administration. But important as it is, education alone is not enough. The young people of our cities especially need job training as well. Now, we saw federal support for job training increase sharply in the 70s. Some of the programs worked, some of them failed. Another name known to this group, Bernard Anderson, said, and I quote, "It is essential that the programs with the best performance records be expanded while those offering no measurable benefits be abandoned." That's the important distinction that we ought to make between the things that work and the things that simply don't work. It isn't a question of reducing total funding. It is rather targeting our resources on those programs that do work. There are, after all, solid investments in human dignity, productivity, and independence that ought to be made. I have supported the $2 billion youth employment initiative that was finally recommended this year. I only regret that a candidate who campaigned in 1976 on the promise to create more job opportunities had to wait nearly 4 years to even begin to act on that promise by making that proposal. I focused for a few minutes now on the problem of youth unemployment, but the plight of unemployed women as well. Women with families locked into a cycle of poverty and welfare dependency is equally serious. And contrary to some popularly expressed beliefs, we can do something about it. There are recent studies that show that the supported work program has significantly increased employment and earnings for many participants, especially long-term welfare recipients. I propose that we expand this and other successful programs. We don't know whether they will work as well on a larger scale, but isn't it worth a try? Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said that if a program doesn't work, try something else until you find something that does work. That's the kind of approach that my administration will take to these problems. We have got, if we want to solve the problem that I'm now addressing, we've got to have decent care during the daytime for the children of working mothers. And I have strongly supported expanded aid for cost-effective home and neighborhood daycare centers in our communities. And let me also say, and this is a little parenthetical at this point, but it has been distorted in the record, sometimes it's been published across the country. I have supported the Humphrey Hawkins bill, and I am committed to the goal of full employment for all our people. Let me say just a word about our nation's cities, for it is there that the great majority of black Americans live. And if our cities decline, so will the well-being of the people who reside there. And our cities are in trouble. Contrary to many people's opinions, the older cities of this country are worse off than they were 10 years ago. And my administration, therefore, would also make urban policy a central concern. And it would seek to target that aid, and mark me well on this, it would direct the bulk of federal assistance to the neediest cities. It seems to me we have to have some scale of priorities. That's only common sense. Last month I was in Seattle, and I addressed the U.S. Conference of Mayors and set forth the outline of my urban program. And the program that I will release after the Democratic Convention at the end of this month will spell out in even greater detail what I consider to be a vital urban strategy for our nation. But very quickly and very generally, the foundations of our older cities, their roads and bridges and sewers and water mains, are crumbling and neglected. And older cities, in all too many cases, have been obliged to let their basic capital plant run down while they simply try to keep abreast of operating needs. And when maintenance is deferred, it is usually the oldest, the poorest sections of our cities that suffer most heavily. I have proposed, therefore, a $4 billion annual urban reinvestment trust fund to rebuild the foundations of our cities and thereby, I believe, to create the kind of conditions that will result in the relocation of industry and bringing jobs to the people who live there. I have also proposed a $4 billion annual community transportation fund to be used to provide long-term financial support for the capital and operating costs of the mass transit systems on which so many people are completely dependent. We can't let those systems be cut back. We can't force the poor in our cities to finance them by simply continuing to escalate fares. Rebuilding those transportation systems is also going to pay an additional dividend in that it is going to provide, I believe, an important source of jobs for the jobless in these areas. And I want to tell you, as one who voted for that provision that was recently held to be constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, I, as one who originally supported the 10% set-aside, will ensure that minority contractors get their fair share of the new construction work generated. I have also supported the idea of a permanent standby revenue stabilization program that would be automatically triggered by sharp drops in local revenues. And I also have suggested these initiatives. They include the fact that for all too long, the federal government's purchase of goods and services and the location of civilian and military installations have been biased. Those selections have been biased against the older cities of our nation. And I think these policies ought to be altered so that all areas receive their fair share of federal business. We ought to make greater use of the Economic Development Administration, of community block development grants, of the urban development action grants, to fund projects that create jobs on a fair basis throughout, and I underscore that word, throughout each city. I have spoken out publicly, and I am opposed to the excessive use of federal funds for large showcase-type projects, hotels and shopping malls and convention centers that concentrate benefits in just a favored few areas of our cities. I don't think that's the best way to rebuild them. A new idea has been floated, and surprisingly enough, it's attracted support from conservatives and liberals and Democrats and Republicans, and maybe that ought to make us suspicious, but I prefer to think that maybe we ought to give it a try, and that is the idea of enterprise zones, where we would try to bring in light industry, small business particularly, by reducing some of the burden of federal and local taxes that inhibit the growth of economic activity in these areas. Housing. We aren't going to improve the quality of life in our cities unless there is decent, affordable housing. And the trends are not good. We have seen just in the last 3 years a net decline of almost 2% in rental units, high interest rates, increased operating costs, burdensome regulations have almost shut down the private construction of rental units. I know what I'm talking about. I talked to a man the other day in my investigation of this problem who said for the last 15 years, I have been building 1,000 units a year in this particular city, and now he says I'm not building a run. Why? Because of an administration that seems to be geared to a policy of high interest rates that, sure, they've gone down a little bit in the last few weeks, and now, if you notice, just in the last few days, they are suddenly beginning to come up again. But in many cities, I think as a result of these policies, there is no vacant inhabitable rental housing. Now, in the early 70s, we did subsidize, as you recall, the construction of new rental housing. And it kind of peaked in 1976. And then, because of soaring costs and fiscal constraints, we saw a very sharp decline. I am afraid, and it doesn't really please me to make this prediction, that if we do not act now, scarce, expensive housing could become a major source of social conflict in the 1980s. And so I would support new initiatives to stimulate the construction of multifamily housing, increased shallow interest rate subsidies, increased tax incentives, including accelerated depreciation for multifamily buildings. I would support an urgent effort to increase the supply of urban housing by returning abandoned or seriously dilapidated housing stock to usable condition. I think restrictions in recent years that have been placed on HUD funds for renovation of existing housing ought to be relaxed. Programs like Urban Homesteading that would mobilize local renovation efforts ought to be expanded. I think we need to remember that we have lacked for a long time a colorblind immigration policy. The preamble of our Constitution enshrines the establishment of justice as a fundamental purpose of our political institutions. A society in which all enjoy equal opportunity to develop their gifts, to go as far as their energies and their talents will allow. You know, the wonderful thing about blacks in this country, and this is not the only audience of this kind that I've addressed in recent months, there have been many other occasions, and I always marvel at the fact that despite the abuses, despite the disappointments that stretch back through 300 years of settlement history on this continent, that black Americans have somehow held fast to their faith in this ancestral vision of all Americans. After a decade in which this faith has once again, and it is that decade about which I commented as I began my speech, the decade of the 70s, after a decade in which this faith has once again been sorely tried, let us together, my friends, resume our broken journey toward a new and purposeful America, truly indivisible, with liberty and justice for all our people. Thank you.